This is an interview with Reverend Wickwire for the McClellan Jackson Project of the Maryland Historical Society on June 15, 1976 at his office. The interviewer is Michael Louis.
Well, perhaps you can begin by telling me what made you become an active person in the civil rights movement?
Well, I think this is probably a little bit difficult to do. Why I became an active person in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Well, I had, shortly after I came to Baltimore, in this position at Johns Hopkins University, I was approached by people around Morgan State who students were not permitted to go to movies over in the theater near them in Northwood. And I suppose that was my first response to working in the civil rights movement, at least in Baltimore, Maryland. And that doesn't account for why I did it. But in any case, I did begin over there. I think that it's... I probably have had some feelings about social justice. I did my PhD in the area of biblical ethics at Yale, and it may be that it was some of this, you know, studying, reading the prophets and working with people like Richard Niebuhr and Liston Pope and other persons who were very much into the field of social ethics and Christian ethics that I felt that I should be concerned and should be involved in whatever way I could. So that maybe has something to do with it. Now, I think as I went along, my greater involvement came about in part having gone to, in 61, I went to the Middle East and I went to the Soviet Union and got a feeling there. And this also in 1962, I went to the Soviet Union and took a group of students and stayed there for the whole summer. And during that period of time, our students and I were put on trial. And it was a people's trial, but it was a traumatic experience and it was frightening to everybody. I think that coming back from that experience, it made me more determined that I would do what I could in America. That I became more aware of and more appreciative of the United States, but also more aware of the flaws in our system. And I think more concerned, perhaps, to try to do what little I could to help, take seriously and to implement some of our ideals about justice and equality and liberty and all of this kind of thing. So I think that perhaps heightened that particular thing.
So what role did you play as a civil rights activist?
Well, here in Maryland, as I said, I early was involved with attempting to desegregate the Northwood Theater. So that involved meetings with the theater owners and things like that, and demonstrations and working with people, especially around Morgan. And then actually in the early 60s, attempting to desegregate places of public accommodation. I was involved in a number of activities where we would go and demonstrate, you know, wherever, whether it would be at restaurants or whether it would be at, where it might be. It might be going down to Ocean City to try to get those people to open up swimming facilities and the use of the beaches and meeting with officials down there, or here in the Baltimore City. Now, I worked very much with CORE at that time. Now, I don't know whether you've heard of Walter Carter, who was one of the, probably the most significant civil rights leader during this period of time. I think he died around in 1971, but he was the key civil rights leader, I would say, in Maryland. And go ahead, you're going to say.
Yes, even compared to Mrs. Lily Mae Jackson, you say?
Well, I would say that Walter Carter, of course, was a much younger person, and the role that Walter Carter played, I suppose, depended in part upon his capacity to relate to all kinds of people, whether it was to militant individuals, very militant, or relate to the mayor of a town, or to be able to relate and to witness and to give leadership. So that I would suggest that Walter Carter's role in terms of organization and leading was probably very key during this period. Now, there are other leaders, of course, and I knew Lillie Mae Jackson well, and I know the family and like it. Now, I don't know whether you want me to go back a moment. I know I digressed a little bit about my own involvement, but in the early 60s, I don't know whether you want me to say a little bit more about this. So.
Yes, we'll
all right, well, I've indicated our concern with public accommodations, and in 63, I was involved with CORE and then with the clergy in the integration of Gwin Oak Park. Now, this park was the only amusement park in the area, and I guess it was the only one, the major one in the state of Maryland, and blacks were not permitted to use this park. And so that was an event that...
But if I may interrupt you,
ahead.
That was in 1963.
That was in 63.
But I think there were national attention was directed there.
Correct.
Yourself and other local clergymen.
Yes.
Why was this place selected, or why was Maryland selected? Was there any particular reason why Park was selected?
Now, I've got documents that would explain about how all this happened, and I'd need to look that up. But it's I think that the National Council of Churches probably was ready at that moment and looking for some spot on which they could focus attention, and there were some of the individuals here in Baltimore that were alert, and I would say especially in CORE, that got in touch with the National Council of Churches, and then it worked out this way. I think that the time was right for it, and Baltimore was a kind of a choice location. There had been a few demonstrations. Some of us had been demonstrating out at the Gwin Oak Park before this happened, and then it was possible to simply to indicate that this would probably be an ideal spot to test things out, to go for it. And CORE was very, really very active in this, in the activity.
Can I just take you back one?
Go ahead.
You mentioned something about Walter Carter and his ability to relate more or less to the whole community. Does that suggest that Mrs. Lillie Mae Jackson could not relate to the community as such?
No, I'm not suggesting anything like that, because undoubtedly the contribution she made to human dignity and to civil rights struggle was, it was very significant, very enormous. I think what I am saying is that Walter Carter, probably as a very active young man, was giving, this very dynamic leadership and moving, at various levels. That's all that I'm saying. And that my contacts were, with a lot of people, but probably especially with him, with Walter Carter, and his working both with blacks and with whites, and so that this was. And he was extremely able, and as I've said, in terms of his capacity to relate to persons. And all over the city, you'll find people today that really came up in a way. I mean, they derived a great deal from his inspiration and from his leadership. And many of them are in, key spots in different kinds of agencies or schools like in Baltimore today. Go ahead, you may have some other.
As a clergyman, would you say there was any difference in approach to civil rights between the white churches and the black churches in Baltimore? Yeah. Or did they work together?
Yes, they did work together, although I would say that the black churches gave more leadership than the white churches did. Now, at this particular time, I don't know who else you're talking to, but key individuals in the black churches, the leadership, Marion Bascom, Frank Williams, and Robert Newbold. Now, Newbold's no longer in the city, and neither is Frank Williams. These are clergymen that have gone elsewhere. But in a measure, these people gave very basic leadership. Vernon Dobson was a leader, but these other three men, somewhat older, were at that moment very key persons. Now, you had other church, you had, you know, other persons that were active, and not everybody in the black church is going to go into the streets or going to demonstrate. I think that you're aware of that. And actually, one of the phenomena about the whole thing here is that when Martin Luther King came to Baltimore, he was not always in touch with the black leaders that were really doing the civil rights activity. Now, I have gone to the Civic Center when he spoke there, when there wasn't one of those three major black leaders on the platform with him. Now, there was some communication problem, but I'm, you know, giving you where the major leadership came from. I mean, in terms of the black clergy. Now, Walter Carter, as I said, stood somewhat alone here, but he worked with the black clergy, with the white clergy as they would work with him. Now, as far as the white clergy are concerned, key leadership was given by Father Joseph Conley in the Catholic Church. And I would say, I'm trying to think about some of the other rabbis that were pretty involved. Lieberman was Joshua Lieberman. He's now deceased. And other persons that worked, some like Schusterman, who's still alive, and various other individuals. But the persons I've spoken about were key individuals in terms of leadership. You had others, and I know I'm not naming all of them, but persons like Harold Dobson, brother of Vernon, there were, you know, a lot of persons. Now, I don't know whether you want to move on to the next thing, but in...
I would just ask you one question on this, whether these people are working or with the NAACP, these black clergymen you've just mentioned.
Oh, yes, they worked with the NAACP, sure. And I think that the NAACP is highly respected here, and we know the tremendous kind of a contribution that has been made by Clarence Mitchell over in Washington, and everything he had to do with the civil rights bills, that certainly they worked with him, and the legal people, I mean, like with Bob Watts and others, the lawyers that worked, so that there was cooperation, and people made, and agencies or groups made different kinds of contributions. So, now, I was going to mention the 1964, that now, 63 was the integration of Gwin Oak Park, and I think that was the March on Washington with Martin Luther King. That was the big one. Now, in 64, we worked on trying to stop Wallace. I was a co-chairman of a group to stop Wallace when he came up and ran in the primaries. And Brewster was the one who ran against him in the state. Brewster was not a strong candidate, and but in any case, that was an interesting experience. We brought a truth squad up from Alabama, actually my office. We brought, there was Amelia Boynton from Selma, Alabama. She's a realtor down there. That's really before that Selma was on the map. And then we brought a person up from SNCC. And we had a truth squad, and we followed Wallace around. Now, that was, as I said, an interesting struggle. The other thing that summer that I spent almost all of my summer on, and some nights when I was at least three nights up all night with this, segregationists, the whites, had gotten together petitions and got like 22,000 signatures to try to keep Maryland from having a public accommodations law. We did get a federal law, but we wanted the state law. So they had gotten to see that we didn't have a state law. So we, some of us, spent the summer, and I was co-chairman of this thing with Frank Williams, to...
Which thing?
Well, of a committee that... committee to uphold the public accommodations law, CUPL. So we trained about 300 people. We used a computer, we had lawyers, we had a handwriting expert, and we went through, we took went down to Annapolis and spent some considerable days Xeroxing copies of every one of the signatures. Then we took them, we trained people, and we went into every political subdivision to the voter registrar to check the names against to see whether they were false or if some, like one person had written a lot of names down. We found a lot of things. And so that was a whole summer of this job. And we did it right here in this area. Then this was a different area. But we, as I said, we trained 300 people. And the outcome, we were not able to get into court, but we would have gone into court if we'd lost on the ballot, but we won. It was question five. We won, so that it was a victory. And so those were two things in 64, this particular involvement. And we had a good cross-section of persons, you know, involved in, you know, in this activity. It was trained using Fortran sheets and all of this stuff, and then some of us working with a computer.
What was the governor, Theodore McKeldin, doing at this time?
Well, see, McKeldin, at that time, the governor that I had most dealings with was Taws. And I would say that, now I knew McKeldin primarily in his capacity as mayor. I knew him in the other capacity, but I didn't have too many dealings with him. And I met him many times, and I think that McKeldin was a genuine believer in civil rights, and that he did, he worked for civil rights. I don't think there's any question about that. There were some instances where there wasn't too much that he was able to do. At this, in 64, I'm just trying to think of what his particular role was then. Taws, I can remember going to meetings with Governor Taws. He was very old when he was in office, and but I didn't have dealings any particular dealings with McKeldin when he was in the governor's office. But I do know that he played a significant role in civil rights.
Coming back to the role of the churches, what were the attitude towards militant groups who rejected the nonviolent approach?
Well, I think that probably most of the churches were afraid of them. I'm sure they were. Persons who would work with them, persons like Walter Carter. If you take the Soul School, I'm not saying that was so militant, but if you take the Black Panthers, probably most of the churches would have been cautious about relating to them. But this would vary, you know, from I would say from clergyman to clergyman and church to church. And there's a fair amount of conservatism, as you know, in the churches. And I can remember when in 1964, I set up meetings in the churches in East and West Baltimore. And I know that there were clergymen in the churches, especially in some of them, they wanted to be sure, for instance, that I was not way out on the left or a communist. They weren't letting somebody come in that was going to, you know, all I was trying to do is to set up a meeting so that they could listen to Brewster. And I'm just saying that there was a fair amount of conservatism that was in evidence. And not all the clergy in the black or the white churches responded in the same way. And the white clergy they found it more difficult, undoubtedly, to move along and to come into participation. I can remember some occasions when it was clear that there was a fair amount of struggle and soul searching going on with the white clergy, especially. Now, one of the things that probably helped in 63 with Gwinnett Park is that some key people came down, bishops, you know, and I remember Bill Coffin came. I can't remember the name of some of the the people from New York State. But, the Presbyterian who was head of the National Council of Churches came down. Eugene Carson Blake, and as I recall, came down so that they helped give some kind of a tone from the national level to say to clergymen here, come on, and it gave some encouragement to the local clergy to participate when you had leaders from elsewhere that would come in and walk with them in this experience. So this was helpful. But many of them came reluctantly, and this was a kind of a fortuitous choice, I think, with that Winnow Park. I know I'm going back. And it did get a lot of national attention and helped to get things moving in other spots. And by the way, I spent a little time in jail at that time on some weekends. And in fact, I was taking summer school at Harvard, so I was flying back and forth to my classes and then spent a little time in jail here on weekends part of the time, or other weekends in the with meetings then with the Human Relations Commission and with the then county executive Agnew up in the county. He was the person that threw us in jail.
Yes. Well, I'll come back to him a little later. But thinking now of your protests and your arrests, what significance you think this had on the whole civil rights fight, the whole fight for equality?
Well, I think that probably it was the exposure in the press, in the media, that when it became clear to persons in the community that, there was a feeling on the part of different individuals that what was going on was wrong, the discrimination was wrong, and that persons were willing to pay a bit of a price for it, I think that it had an effect on the public. And I suppose that I would think was probably significant. I think that also it gave impetus in terms of if some people took a position and other persons, came along and took a stand or were willing, and it probably helped move the whole picture along. Now, I would say about integration of things down at Ocean City, I was involved with Walter Carter and other persons in a number of meetings with officials from there. Now, in Ocean City, there was fear on the part of officials that Corps and other groups would come down and close the place down in the summer. In the winter it's closed, maybe like 1,000 people there, and then in the summer 100, 120,000. And they were afraid, and probably the strength of the civil rights movement was not nearly as strong as they thought. Because I've gone down on occasion where maybe there would be two carloads of us, and we were sort of a pitiful-looking crowd. What could we? But they didn't realize that we didn't have all of that strength. And they really moved well and opened up. So I would say that another result, then, not only encouraging people to take stands, but also encouraging the government maybe to make moves and to support, desegregation and to get those persons who were violating, the rights of other humans to open up. And then there was the fear element of it that, if a pretty big crowd could be collected to demonstrate here at Gwin Oak Park, what if people did come under to other things? And so it had this kind of an effect, I think, of making more, groups and firms more willing to respond and open up and to the civil rights movement, desegregate.
You mentioned Governor Agnew a while mm-hmm. ago.
Yeah.
Now, I know following the death of Martin Luther King, there were about 3 or 4 days of riots here in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And then he blamed all this on the black leaders.
Yeah.
But I think you were suggesting a while ago that you were active then.
Yes, that's true.
Is it that he was not aware of what was going on?
That Agnew was not aware?
Yes.
Well, Agnew, he got to be vice president almost out of that speech he made to the black leaders. What Agnew did, I'm sure he realized what he was doing, but he was a pretty insensitive person in many ways. I've been at lots of meetings with him where if anybody disagreed with him, he'd get up, his face apoplectic red, and walk out of the meeting. And he couldn't stand any kind of disagreement. And I would, as far as the his attitude here, I think in a measure he had some knowledge of what he was doing, and that to abuse and harass verbally, you know, the people that had been really trying to help the situation. This is what was so infuriating about it, that the guy comes in and chastises men who'd been working day and night to try to see that there wasn't a lot of bloodshed. And it was such a stupid thing, you know, from the point of view of morality and what was right. And yet for him it paid off, making people think he's tough, he's able to handle situations or something, so it sort of helps catapult him into the national limelight, and that's part of the outcome. Now, I was chairman of a group then. We took out full-page ads against Agnew. We got a lot of people. It cost us quite a bit of money. I'd have to check back on the details because we did this more than once. But the Sun papers would not take our ad. It was over. You know, they later apologized because of not about this ad against Agnew. They wouldn't take it. But the Afro took a full-page ad, and the News American would take it. But the Sun papers.
Not the Sun papers.
No. No, I have that, some of that stuff else. I don't recall exact things, but. Let's see. I'm just trying to think under what, because we had a committee for political responsibility. I think that this was the group that, and I was happened to be chairman of that, and that we had also tried, supported, well, this is a little bit later. This is working with the Black Panthers. Yeah. That was a little bit later. But
was that committee mainly religious and
no.
leadership?
Lawyers, political scientists, and anybody that was a concerned person, you know. No, it was not mainly religious. No.
That suggests this committee was fairly radical, would you say?
You mean that committee?
Yes.
No. I would say, you're talking about the committee that did which now?
You told me.
With the Black Panthers?
Yes.
No, that was around 70 or 71. Well, it was, I don't know exactly what you mean by radical. What we tried to do, we tried to see, for instance, that the police didn't go in and shoot up the Black Panthers. And there were some nights that we had people down in front of their place all night. And I went down a few times, you know, myself in the middle of the night, maybe at 3 a.m. And we got some press coverage and got some exposure. I think we did help avoid a lot of bloodshed here in Baltimore. Now, the police commissioner was, of course, highly incensed by what we did. And I know he publicly bragged about having taped me, had conversations of mine with the Panthers. He bragged about that over at the at a meeting of the black leaders at the Afro, and at least six people came later and told me that he had said that, and that, you know, I should watch out, that he's out to get me. But I would not say that that group was especially radical. I thought they were responsible people, and we came out with a statement about what we thought ought to be the case in terms of, we tried to play a mediating role here, and you know, to prevent, bloodshed and harassment. And it wasn't that we condoned violence. We made that clear that we didn't. But we wanted to see that justice was done, and that something didn't happen here like happened in Chicago or the West Coast.
If I may go back about 1963, for example,
mm-hmm.
I noticed that students from Morgan State were very active in things like sit-ins. There was another group, I think, which called itself the Civil Integration Movement,
yeah.
Or Civil. Did that suggest that people were dissatisfied with the traditional civil rights leaders, or was it part of a continuing movement?
You mean the fact that there was a separate organization over
yeah,
there?
Or how closely were they mm-hmm. associated then with that?
Now, I think at that time, it was a young man by the name of Burroughs that headed up, it was called Civic Integration Group, I think. There were some
yeah.
other leaders that I knew all of those people pretty well. Now, no, I just think that you had people of different levels that worked best, perhaps with their, you know, their peers. This is simply, it was a kind of, these were sort of natural groupings. And when we would have, you know, demonstrations, often, you know, the representatives from all of the groups that would go, that were involved, so it didn't mean, it meant some dissatisfaction, undoubtedly, and may probably be dissatisfaction with the clergy, that maybe the feeling they weren't moving fast enough. Now, I can recall, for instance, at the integration of Gwin Oak Park, after we had gotten an agreement with the owners of that place to cut, you know, to stop discriminating, now we gave them a very short period of time in which to settle things up and to clear the deck so that they could absolutely go for this. Now, we, and then I can recall that there were some of the younger, very few people. Well, what I was pointing out is that there was some disagreement about tactics on occasion, and this is an example of such an occasion. But on the whole, I would say that people work together, you know, quite well, you know, coming from different levels. And although perhaps the some of the younger generation felt that the clergy didn't move fast enough, and as I said, they probably didn't, not all of them. Some of them were willing and spent a lot of time at this. And the other thing I wanted to say is that the fact that Morgan had been, had a tradition of trying to open up that Northwood Theater, you know, to people, meant that they had people who'd been accustomed to doing some picketing and, you know, demonstrating.
Would you say these black leaders appeal to what we would call the man in the street? How well were they aware of what they were trying to do? Say, how well were they aware of what Mrs. Jackson was trying to do?
The people in the street?
Yeah, what one would call the man in the street. Did he know of Mrs. Jackson and what she was trying to do, do you think?
I doubt if they knew that much about what was going on. No, I think that that probably the person in the street was not that aware. You know, if they followed things in the newspapers, they would, or here on the radio and television, yes, they must have, they had to know something about it. But there was not an involvement, really, you know. And so, no, I don't think that the... they were aware, and again, who you mean by the man on the street? If these are persons that like wouldn't be touched by the church as much, you mean, or these are persons that at a economic level where they are, the social level where they wouldn't have much chance to discuss, you know, wouldn't be discussing things like this too much.
Yeah, that leads me to my next question. Most of the leaders so far we have mentioned, Carter.
Yeah.
Or Mrs. Jackson, were closely related to the church. Did that sort of hamper them in their effectiveness as leaders?
Well, let me mention Carter as a better, maybe as an example of... I don't think so. I don't think that... I think that, now especially with Carter, while he was tied in with the church, he was also very critical of its failures and flaws. He was... very aware of them, and yet he was able to relate to the churches. But a person like Carter was relating, you know, with people that were concerned, that felt they had a stake in the thing. He was able to relate them to them. And if you take, you know, I don't know if you, well, at whatever stage, somebody, Luke Bullough, who ran the Soul School, or if you take all of the people that ran CORE, different times, Jim Griffin, or whoever it might be, whatever the white people, whoever they might be involved with it, Carter was able to relate them, whether they were part of the church or not. And somebody like John Romer, who's now head of ACLU, John Romer was very active with Walter Carter, and a young white person at that time. I don't think they were hurt. These people, like, you know, Lily Mae Jackson or Walter Carter, by identification with the church. I think it was whether they, people felt that they were honest and serious, you know, sincere and concerned. That was what was important, I think, and whether they gave leadership. And put themselves on the line.
What about the press, the Afro-American press during that period? How effective would you say it was? Well, it frequently carried some banner headlines, for example.
Yeah.
Did that, would you say this helped the cause?
I'm sure it did. Oh yes, I'm sure that it did. I think that it was very important. And although I recall, you know, trying to get to, I don't remember now exactly what all I was trying to get do, but at the time, just think about the press, at the time that we were trying to just get Wallace defeated in the state, that was in 64, there were people in a church at Selma, I still have those probably, the petition signatures, they got together and really risked themselves, these are blacks, 200 or more of them signed a statement to us, to telling us what Governor Wallace was like, and sent that up to us. Now, I went to both to the Afro-American and to the Sun papers, and almost on my knees begged them to do something with this material and to give some support.
The Afro-American?
Yeah, and I don't think that they did. And I'd have to check this. I want to check back on that, but I can remember, and especially with the Sun papers, you know, these people signed that statement down there at, you know, risk to themselves, and we were trying to give them some kind of coverage up here that would maybe give them some support and help, and I can remember going to the editor, getting to see Day, of the editor of the Sun, and pleading with him to do something with it. And I went to the Afro, and as I recall, neither paper would do anything with this. So, but I would say on the whole.
Why wouldn't the Afro, for example, take this?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they didn't realize the significance of it at the time. That's before Selma, Alabama really became important in King's thing. And it was I was spending, you know, most of my time on this sort of thing. And like in the summer of 64, I spent my whole summer on this thing. And there were three nights, I stayed up all night with the computer, and we're trying to get our stuff ready, and you know, raising money, and we're training people. But so I was very much caught up with it. But I, on the whole, the Afro played a very important role in keeping people aware of what was going on. And I'd say that during the summer of 64, when we were going through this thing on the committee to uphold the public accommodations law, we got a lot of coverage in the papers, what progress we're making, what's being discovered about fraud and all of that sort of thing, and documents. And I would say that the paper played an important role. And, well, there was something else I was going to mention, which isn't too significant probably, but in 63, the integration of Gwinnett Park, I can remember spending one night in jail when Schwimmer, he was one of the three persons that was killed, and then later done when they, you know, the three young civil rights workers were killed down, was it in Alabama, when they were put under with a bulldozer, I don't even remember. I can remember that was at the Gwinn Oak Park thing, and Schwimmer was there one night with us. Well, it was an interesting mixture of persons. Again, I didn't mean to digress, but in regard to, I think the press probably did quite well in terms of, you know, helping with the whole movement. You know, they didn't always do things that I think, you know, might have been done, but. And you mentioned about the NAACP. I think that the lawyers and their readiness, you know, to bail people out and to come to support, and there's a good cooperation, you know, with people and agencies and organizations playing different roles. One thing I was going to say in 68, this is going back to the, you know, year Martin Luther King was killed and the disorders in the city. Of course, what blacks said to those of us who were white at that time was, stay out of the city. You go out and try to change the attitudes in the suburbs. So we began a school out here that summer. we call it response.
Where was that?
Right here on this campus, yeah. We, out of our office, we began this school. We had 500 or 600 people in it, and I suppose about 50 classes. And we had really good people teaching them, really trying to do that, to change the attitudes of persons in the suburbs. And we would train in this same group. We trained guys to go out and speak in the churches, you know, in the suburbs, and to try to make them more aware of what was going on. So we, now during that whole period of time, we carried on a tutoring program. We've been running a tutoring program in the city, see, for about 13 years for elementary age kids. And like ordinarily as now, we would be tutoring 150 inner city kids that need help in reading, 150 volunteers. An awful lot of the groups in 68 stopped tutoring. There were about 25 of them that were doing it. But when disorders occurred and other things, most of the groups stopped the thing. Now, I don't know, I'm going to have to go over to this meeting shortly, but I don't know whether you'd want to come back again sometime, or maybe this is all that, you know. That.
All right, yes, except if I could ask you just one last question.
Yeah.
You mentioned you selected Carter, I think, as the prominent black leader during that period, civil rights. Can you see any prominent white civil rights leader during that period? Would you select McClellan, or who would you?
Well, McClellan was never active like organizing in this during this period I'm talking about. I would not. He was in another category. He was playing his role, you know, and I think sincerely and so on. But he was not, in a way, a man for all seasons or something to get out into the streets and to go and to be able to shift gears and to adjust and do that kind of thing. So I would not see that McClellan was playing the same kind of a role as a Walter Carter. And of course, there was no white person that could play a role like Walter Carter could play it, you know, as a black. And as I've said, you had clergy that played more important roles too. But in many ways, Walter Carter's life began after he got through with his regular job. So it was after 4 or 4:30, whatever it was. But again, Matt McClellan, I had a great deal of respect for McClellan. And it's just that he didn't play the same kind of a role, you know, that some of the other people did. And I don't know whether this this is of some help to you, is it?
Yes, it is. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed talking with you. Okay. I did most of the talking, I guess.
Thank you.